Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, May 13th. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Yurok Wellness Center receives $24 million in funding from the state. Humboldt County is set to ban retail sales of nitrous oxide. A campaign to counter proposed cannabis tax increases gathers pace. And a look back at Murder Mountain with Film Commissioner Cassandra Heseltine, who talks about the death threats she received when the series was released. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. Hot on the heels of the lead item in our news yesterday, that Humboldt County has been awarded $43.5 million for a new psychiatric facility, comes the news that the Yurok Tribe has received a $26.4 million grant to build the Yurok Tribal Health and Wellness Center. The announcement came as California Governor Gavin Newsom held a press conference, along with healthcare leaders on state and local level, to announce the distribution of $3.3 billion for health-related projects throughout the state. Here is Governor Gavin Newsom.
We're saying $3.3 billion is going to be distributed to 124 projects throughout the state of California and supporting 214 new facilities. You will see that almost every part of the state is included. 54 of the 58 counties will be receiving this unprecedented support. Deep gratitude to the voters of California that entrusted us with the biggest investments of any state in American history. This is the most exciting work that's happening in the United States of America on mental health and substance abuse and behavioral health reforms, period, full stop. You combine this with what's happening in our reforms to the Medi-Cal system under CalAIM. You combine that to our unprecedented multi-billion dollar, unprecedented investments into prevention and focusing on early screening, 0 to 26, the investments we're making in care court, conservatorship reforms, driving more accountability across the spectrum of other issues related to homelessness, and ongoing funding for housing. This is a really pivotal time in California's mental health history.
Joseph L. James, the chairman of the Yurok Tribe, said the Health and Wellness Center will, quote, significantly strengthen tribal and non-tribal communities in our rural region. More importantly, it will save lives, end quote. The Yurok Health and Wellness Center will be a 24,000 square foot building with 53 beds. The inpatient and outpatient facility will provide primary care, behavioral health, and mental health services to Yurok tribal members and the surrounding community. According to a press release from the Yurok tribe, the center will offer culturally based and conventional treatment options that aim to address the physical, mental, and social health needs of local residents, ranging from infants to the elderly.
This next story is a difficult one. It involves the tragic deaths of a married couple in Anaheim Hills, a quiet, affluent neighborhood in Southern California. And while the news has made national headlines, it hits especially close to home for those of us here in Southern Humboldt. 40-year-old Allison Barry Guerrera, who was raised and educated in Southern Humboldt, was found dead alongside her 45-year-old husband, Marco Tony Guerrera, inside their home on the evening of May 8th. According to reporting by the Daily Mail, both had suffered gunshot wounds. Police recovered a firearm at the scene, and there were no signs of forced entry or evidence of anyone else being involved. Investigators believe this was a murder-suicide. Though the reports of a domestic violence history are unconfirmed by law enforcement at this time, the initial investigation indicates that Tony shot Allison before taking his own life. The couple lived in a multi-million dollar home in Anaheim Hills. From the outside, their life appeared stable, social media showing smiling photos, snapshots of vacations, kids, and what looked like a happy family. But as so often happens in domestic violence cases, the reality behind closed doors was far more painful. Allison Barry Guerrera wasn't just a headline, she was a daughter, a friend, and a mother of four. Two of those children she shared with Tony. She grew up in Southern Humble, attended local schools, and spent part of her adult life in the community before moving south. Many here still remember her, and the news of her death has left friends reeling. Ryan Hudson, a longtime friend of Allison's and a reporter for KMUD News and Redhead Black Belt, said she was devastated upon hearing the news. Speaking not as a journalist, but as someone who knew her personally, Hudson recalled private conversations over the years in which Allison reportedly confided that she had been experiencing physical abuse. While some, quoted in national media, describe Tony as warm and welcoming, those closest to Allison say she was navigating a much darker reality, one that she hid well, perhaps too well, even from people who cared about her deeply. Domestic violence doesn't always leave visible scars. Often, it leaves emotional ones, long before any physical violence takes place. Isolation, control, jealousy, and fear can all be part of the cycle, signs that Hudson say Tony exhibited. The deaths of Allison and Tony Guerrera have gained wide coverage in the press, but here in Southern Humble, where Allison spent so many of her formative years, the grief feels deeply personal. Friends have shared memories of her kindness, her strength, and her devotion to her children. And as the investigation continues, many are reflecting on the signs of domestic violence that are so easy to overlook until it's too late. If you or someone you know is experiencing abuse, there is help. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24 hours a day at 1-800-799-7233. You can also visit thehotline.org to chat with an advocate. We here at KMUD extend our condolences to all of those touched by this devastating tragedy. Reporting for KMUD News, I'm Lisa Music.
A campaign to counter proposed cannabis tax increases is gathering pace, with 1,600 letters already sent to members of the California legislature. Lauren Schmidt spoke to Ellen Comp, Deputy Director of NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
The cannabis taxes are way out of whack with anything that's going to make for a successful legal industry, as well as the high cost of regulation and getting started in the business. The state excise tax is 15% currently, and come July, it could raise to 19%. And that excise tax is levied not just on the cannabis, but also on packaging, service fees, local taxes, which are enacted at the retail level. And then all of that is subject to a sales tax, so it can be 8.5% or more. So the total tax on cannabis is as much as 48%. That is far more than comparable products like beer, wine, and cigarettes. Like, we did an analysis. A 5-ounce glass of beer is taxed at 5 cents. A glass of wine is only 1 cent. A cigarette is 14 cents. But a cannabis pre-roll is currently taxed at $1.24, and it could rise to $1.57. And that, again, is just the excise tax. That's not all the compound taxes that are added on top. California cannabis businesses have lost 17,600 cannabis jobs in the last 2 years, many of them good union jobs. Other states with lower taxes have a higher per capita cannabis sales. Michigan, for example, which has only 10% state excise tax that it shares with local jurisdictions that don't have any tax, they have per capita cannabis sales of about $300. California has less than $100. In per capita cannabis sales. So it's been calculated that if we were on par with Michigan, we'd be generating an estimated $13 billion in annual sales instead of what we've got on the taxable sales, which was only $4.6 billion last year. So we've been really trying to let the legislature and the governor know that we need to fix this if they want to have any taxes in cannabis. a bill from Assemblymember Haney from San Francisco, AB 564, which would freeze cannabis taxes at the current 15% level. That bill has now gotten through two different committees, and now it goes to the Appropriations Committee this Wednesday, the 14th. Meanwhile, what we were really hoping is if we could show support for this bill, that we could get the governor and or the legislators to fix this problem in the budget bills, which are coming forward again any day now, from the governor and from the legislature. They could fix this in the budget, and that would be the best thing that they could do, because this thing is pending in July. So, we started a letter-writing campaign, which we've gathered already 1,600 or more signatures towards the Assembly, and now we've broadened it to both houses of the legislature, because they both have budget committees, and to the governor, asking them to please freeze the taxes this year. And it's really helping us start the debate about, you know, what we really need to do long-range and long-term to fix it for the consumer and the cannabis businesses. So people can go to our website, canormal.org. They can just click on the little stop sign that says stop higher taxes, yes on AB 564, and use our template letter to write a letter. Add your personal stories, write your own letter. Reach out if you can to Senator Mike McGuire, the senator from up there, who's in a leadership position in the Senate. And is about to leave office, so this is a good chance for him to do something good on his way out. Do all you can to amplify our message.
Ellen Comp there, speaking to Lauren Schmidt. Now we're going to switch over to the Board of Supervisors. And if you're a fan of the old laughing gas, it may be time to stock up. Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County is on its way to banning retail sale of nitrous oxide and related paraphernalia through an ordinance introduced at the May 6th Board of Supervisors meeting. Sponsored by Board Chair Michelle Bushnell and Supervisor Mike Wilson, the ordinance is set for adoption on June 10th and is a step toward broader prohibition. The ordinance is for the unincorporated county area, but Public Health Director Sophia Pereira said a unified policy approach that includes cities is being worked on. As explained by Senior Program Manager Brianna Sherlock, nitrous oxide is a gas that's inhaled by users seeking recreational drug effects, including euphoria and sedation. The trouble is its long-term side effects include memory loss, vitamin B12 depletion, weakened immune system, and neurological damage. As explained by Sherlock, the county checked the availability of nitrous oxide in retail stores spanning all parts of the county.
Our staff were out in the field doing a retail landscape analysis from October to March or to April. They visited a total of 144 retailers throughout Humboldt County, from Soham all the way up to the northern part, now in eastern Humboldt, and of course here in Eel River Valley and Humboldt Bay. And they visited both in unincorporated Humboldt as well as in the city jurisdictions. They did not visit any retailers on tribal land, since those are sovereign nations, and that is not within our jurisdiction. So during their landscape analysis, what they discovered is that of the 144 retailers, 24 retailers had nitrous oxide located within plain sight. 18 of those retail outlets had crackers, canisters, and tanks.
The presentation included descriptions of nitrous oxide equipment, canisters, the crackers that crack them open and dispense the gas for convenient use, and tanks that also dispense nitrous oxide. Pereira summarized the ordinance and its enforcement.
So this would be a ban on the sale of nitrous oxide and associated paraphernalia in unincorporated Humboldt County. There's no exceptions for culinary use, for automotive. It's still permissible for use in healthcare, you know, dental, pharmacy environments, or if it's contained in like canned whipped cream, for example. The enforcement mechanisms, it would be, you know, any person violating this chapter is guilty of a misdemeanor, and upon conviction thereof may be punished by a term in the county jail of up to 6 months or by a fine of $1,000 or both. So this is pretty aligned with state law already around it being a misdemeanor to sell nitrous oxide for illicit use. However, this ban is just an outright sales ban, and so it includes this misdemeanor language. Also includes that it would be a public nuisance, and so that adds another enforcement tool for the county.
Punishments also include loss of business and or tobacco retail sale licenses. In a related agenda item, supervisors approved amending the county's tobacco licensing ordinance to include mention of the nitrous oxide ban. Bushnell referred to presentations from Redway School students earlier in the day, including from her grandson.
One 12-year-old talked about nitrous. The thought was that they talk about something in the community. They're from Southern Humboldt, and that they talk about things in the community that are affecting them or that they're concerned about. And he talked about nitrous oxide and the use. He has a cousin that is paralyzed, and so it's, you know, forefront in his mind and his family's. It's actually my grandson, but that was what he and I didn't know he was going to do that. And so his grandma's passion is his passion as well. So I really want to say thank you. When I came to you guys, I think it's almost 2 years now. Nitrous in the public world, it just really wasn't recognized or wasn't even like, you know, it's whipped cream. What are we talking about here? And so the work you guys have done in that time and the funding you've been able to get and connecting the cities and the sheriff and, you know, just all the things, tremendous amount of work. And I just can't thank you enough.
Bushnell owns the bootleg store in downtown Garberville, and she said the death of one of her employees was nitrous related. Supervisors unanimously approved the nitrous ban ordinance and the tobacco ordinance amendment, with Wilson absent due to the late afternoon timing. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In Mendocino, an old plan to raise the Coyote Valley Dam is getting a new lease on life. KCYX's Elise Cox spoke to Janet Pauly, chair of the Mendocino Inland Water and Power Commission, about a feasibility study to raise the dam by 36 feet.
Pauly said the feasibility study is about 20 years in the making.
Lake Mendocino was never built as a water supply facility. It was built for flood control. And it ended up, when after everybody protested it, and then it was finally there, that everybody realized how critically important it was. But it's only a one-year reservoir. In other words, it can only store 1 year's worth of water supply. When the water stops going into Lake Mendocino, even in the summer when there's some now that still comes in from the Potter Valley Project, it goes down. And it by the end of the summer, on a normal year, there's not a lot of water left in Lake Mendocino. If the rain didn't come that next winter, Lake Mendocino would be dry. So the idea for us was, in terms of, you know, looking at water supply and resiliency for this region, that dam was authorized by Congress back in the 50s to be raised another 36 vertical feet. The borrow ground is there. The easements were set into place all around that lake. The campground facilities and everything were designed with the idea that some of them would be moved. On Highway 20, that bridge over Highway 20 is at that height because they had anticipated raising that dam 36 vertical feet. It never happened. So we went to the Corps in 2005. They agreed that this would be worth looking at, and we started into the project. The Mendocino County Inland Water and Power Commission that I chair was the non-federal local sponsor. And for several years, we matched what federal funding we could get from, in those days, it was Senator Feinstein that came up with the funding. And we did about $1.2 million worth of studies. The Corps had to leave the process to take care of other things across the country that were more pressing. The feasibility study fell away.
The study is back, thanks to an offer by the Lytton Rancheria Pomo Tribe to match $500,000 in federal funding secured by Congressman Jared Huffman. While the study is currently estimated to take 3 years and cost $3 million in total, Polly says that may not be realistic.
Murder Mountain. Chances are, these two words just increased your pulse rate, especially if you live in southern Humboldt. For the uninitiated, Murder Mountain is the title of a documentary series released in late 2018 about cannabis growers in Alder Point in southern Humboldt, an area often referred to as Murder Mountain. The filmmakers who made Murder Mountain the series told locals they'd come to Humboldt County to make a film about the cannabis industry, which at the time was in the midst of the sweeping changes that came with the legalization of marijuana in the state. Here is local cannabis grower Douglas Furr, who was featured in the series, speaking to KMUD in early 2019 after Murder Mountain started streaming on Netflix.
They told me that they had been in the county for a while, that they were looking for a way to focus the story, that they had just shot a Board of Supervisors meeting in which a lot of small growers were very articulately complaining about being crushed by regulation, taxes, fees, consultants, etc., and very emotionally rendering that opinion to the supervisors. And they filmed that, and they then represented to me that what they were planning on doing was making that the story, how the people who had originated the industry were being thrown under the bus.
This stated objective of the documentary makers was also presented to staff at this radio station, which served as a location in episode 1 of the series. When it was released, Murder Mountain did indeed turn out to be about the cannabis industry in Humboldt, but legislation and changes to the industry were relegated to the background, while the disappearance of people in the area and the unsolved 2013 murder of Garrett Rodriguez was front and center. This alleged misrepresentation by the filmmakers and their portrayal of the area as some sort of an epicenter of violence and lawlessness was felt county-wide, even country-wide. For years, perhaps still, Murder Mountain remains one of the chief impressions people have of Humboldt County. Here is Film Commissioner Cassandra Heseltine on the release of Murder Mountain.
It came out about a week, I think, after Bird Box did, which, you know, the Sandra Bullock movie, number one downloaded on Netflix for like a year and a half. And so I was flying high on the success of Bird Box. And then Murder Mountain came out. And then I went to Sundance a couple weeks later. And as I was being introduced at parties or to producers and directors, you know, at screenings, as the Humboldt Del Norte Film Commission, they'd go, oh, Murder Mountain.
Sheriff William Honsall, who was interviewed for the series, said the portrayal of the county was one-sided and sensationalist. During a health recruitment panel discussion last February, Matt Reese, CEO of Southern Humboldt Community Healthcare District, said he preempts discussion about Murder Mountain with every potential hire and highlights how the area has changed. Former supervisor Estelle Fennell also commented on KMUD about her participation in the series.
When I was interviewed for it, I was under the impression we were looking at the whole issue of legalization and what the future of Humboldt is going to look like, that kind of thing. So it is kind of interesting to see that something called Murder Mountain comes out, that they were making a movie about a murder.
Here is Cassandra Heseltine on the filmmaker's real intention.
Did they lie, or did the story change? Now, working in the industry, I know that documentaries notoriously almost every single time start off one way, and over time, as you're interviewing people, the story fleshes itself out and you have a new story by the time you're done. That's the formula of a documentary. There is no script. And it changes, you know, from start to finish. So did it change, or did they always know that's what they were going to do? We have no way of knowing. But that's what they ended up putting out regardless. It, you know, unless it's porn, you know, I can't turn anybody away for the content of what they're doing. You know, I have to be able to answer their questions, say, well, this is how you get a county permit if you're out filming on the county. If you're within the city of Eureka, this is how you get that permit, and connect the dots. They're still spending money. That's my job. It's a requirement. I can't censor what they're filming. I did lecture these guys before I, you know, helped them out with giving them the permit information, just saying, hey, listen, there's a lot more to the community. I hope you do check out these other resources. I hope you do look into the whole story. Just know there's going to be people who will not interview with you. Just know there's going to be people that are going to want you to tell it all. And please don't lie to the community. You know, so I did give them that full on lecture, and then I gave them the resources they needed.
Whatever the filmmaker's real intentions were, the final outcome caused plenty of emotions locally. Here is what some of the KMUD listeners had to say at the time.
I watched the whole thing. It was definitely dramatized as it could be. And everyone who participated in it, I don't care if they claim they were duped or not, they duped themselves by participating to use their ego to be in this show.
I am a mom, and my child lives in the southern Humboldt area. And I watched this series a few days ago, and it left me just horrified and frightened. I had no idea of the extent of violence that was happening in the area, and it really shook me, and it left me very frightened for my child living in that area.
I think the community's reaction to it tells a lot about what people are paying attention to and how divided our community is. Like, there's so many people's reaction was, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not the Humboldt County I know. I've never seen anything like that. And meanwhile, there's plenty of other people popping up going, yeah, that sounds about right. Missing people and murder victims and sketchy growers.
I had always wondered about that case. I mean, I remember when I heard about it on the news, it left a lot more questions than it answered. And the documentary really answered a lot of those questions.
I think the stories they focus on were super sad and tragic. And a lot of the characters they got obviously don't represent maybe the best of this area, the best of our community. So, yeah, people are upset, but those stories are true. You know, there's a lot of missing people. There's murders that go uninvestigated. So, you know, you can be upset about it, but those are true stories. You know, why didn't the county investigate that murder to the point where citizens have to kind of get involved to that extent?
While the makers of Murder Mountain took a lot of heat for their portrayal of the area, the anger over the series took a dark turn for Commissioner Heseltine.
I got death threats over it. You know, people thought that somehow I was doing something that was doing, you know, and it's just, it's not cool. You know, like I can't pick and choose. I have no way to know what they're doing, you know, and we just hope that people are honorable and do better. But, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do.
You got death threats like locally about that you were promoting bad things about Humboldt?
Yes. I had a cannabis grower call me and threaten my life. They knew me because of a previous project that they had been on years prior. And I was able to kind of talk them down and say, you know, come on, you know me. I have nothing to do with this. I have no say in the matter. I can't control it. You know, it was disconcerting, you know, for a minute to go, what? You know, like, it's not my fault. You know, yeah. Who knew this job would be so scary?
6 years later, Heseltine is able to laugh a very serious incident off. But tempers in Southern Humboldt remain high to this day, typified by comments on Red-Headed Black Belt following a story the news site published about the series just last week. This was the third and final part of our interview with Humboldt and Del Norte Film Commissioner Cassandra Heseltine. You can catch the first two parts on your favorite podcast platform by searching for KMUD News. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks to our engineer, Katie Phillips, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Lauren Schmidt, and Elise Cox. I'm Sigurd Bjørn. Thank you for listening.
KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmut.org.